How are
Yay!
you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good too. Yes.
We're all good. I love it. boy, just been listening to Joan do the weekly wrap up of the lessons this week, and boy, are these some spectacular lessons. And really hitting me this year, even though I've done these things every year for the last, God, how many years? 8 or so, and done them along with Ken, doing the journey through the workbook. But somehow or the other, this year, the lessons I'm really getting that he's not kidding around, which is, I mean, that's a terrible thing to say because, have I been thinking all this time that, Jesus is just fooling around here? Or, have I just thought, wow, this is really nice, and if only I could think this way, and if only I had these ideas in my own thinking. But, this year I am having those ideas in my own thinking. So, it is quite a different experience for me, Bruce.
Well, cool. I think it's kind of funny. It's I and I use that word, both pun intended and maybe not, I guess. But I guess it's a reminder that the seriousness of the course is really that we not take ourselves seriously. It's actually kind of funny that the reality that we all share is so peaceful and so beyond concern that the only thing that really need concern us, ironically, is that we not be overly fearful or worried or concerned about what seems to be happening in our world. I just woke up a few minutes ago. Maybe it
That's
sounds
okay.
like it. The usual, stagger to the bathroom and look at this character, in the mirror is like, oh yeah, this is a joke. It's a joke to think that time can come to circumvent eternity. And not any kind of a mean-spirited joke, but just and I love how Ken Wapnick says, in one of his latest, audios, he had this little childlike impish voice and said, describing the Holy Spirit, saying, "Come on, it's a joke. It's a joke. It's silly. Come on, get the gear. Just sit and listen with me for a minute. It's just a silly joke that we could possibly have shattered perfect oneness. That we could have possibly taken this beautiful, perfect, flawless unity, and somehow broken it apart into all these, gazillion pieces." And it occurred to me that a really good metaphor is the not only a broken mirror, because the mirror is something that reflects the truth or reflects, something, in terms of the more general definition of a mirror. But another metaphor that really works nicely, I think, is and also then it could be a broken hologram, if you want to think of it that way, because we all have the same essence, and each piece of a hologram has that same awareness. Another metaphor that fits in really nicely with that is the Sorcerer's Apprentice. And if anybody's seen the classic Fantasia movie, where Mickey Mouse is the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and he's left alone to take care of the wizard's lab, the magician's lab, and of course he cast the spell upon a broom to make it do the tidying up, thinking that, well, that's going to make things better, I'll do this off on my own. And then by the time the sorcerer comes back, the broom is split into countless copies or clones of itself and has made a mess of things. And in the Disney film, in the classic one from decades ago, there's it's flooding, and there's just this total chaos happening with all these brooms trying to make things better, But I think what a great metaphor. And what's interesting is a couple of years ago, driving around where I lived in Colorado, I happened to have a classical music station on. They were playing the music from A Sorcerer's Apprentice, and in that music, there's the implication from the story. Well, not in the music, but in the story that I remember hearing as a kid about the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and in the Disney film, I think reflects that to a certain degree, is when the sorcerer returns, there's the expectation of anger and punishment and outrage and that sort of thing. But it's interesting that the musician who wrote the music to the Sorcerer's Apprentice, I'm not sure which came first, the Disney film or the music of the same name. The commentator, she was talking about the composer's intent for the music to the Sorcerer's Apprentice, said, well, when the sorcerer returns, they are completely unaffected by what the apprentice has done. And because of that, there's no blame, there's no censure, there's no, admonishment or anything. And, all is forgiven. And I thought, wow. And I just happened to be, tuning the radio to that station at that time and got that. And it was like, wow, what a wonderful, wonderful reminder that, we think that because, and that's where the entire universe arose out of this massive, unfounded, unconscious guilt. And it's unconscious because we don't want to look at it. And we made up the whole universe to hide behind, thinking that we've done somebody wrong, song, that we messed up big time. But the unfounded part of it is really where the true relief is there's no foundation. There's no basis in truth for our anxiety and our dread of being found out of, we messed up perfect oneness.
Exactly.
Because nothing happened. It's a silly joke. It's not. I love how Ken says it's not evil. It's not sinful. It's not wicked. It's just silly.
It's just
a silly joke. And the when the sorcerer returns in the musical version of the composer's mind anyway, that it's like, oh well, no problem. We can fix this easily because nothing happened. Not a single note in Heaven's Song was missed. And
exactly.
That is the perspective I think that we have whenever we start to go down the habitual ego knee-jerk reaction road, catch ourselves more quickly each time and say, wait a minute, this does not serve me. It does not serve the person or persons I'm with or the animals or the objects or the whether it's a technology situation or just the glass I'm holding or the chair I'm sitting on or the microphone I'm speaking through or the curtains or if you just look around there, that's why those early workbook lessons are so powerful, I think, is because they basically undermine the unfounded unconscious guilt right at the source.
Especially these ones here that we're having in the last few days, which go on until for a while. Mm-hmm. that they're ones that are telling me something about myself that I do not know.
Right.
And someone I was listening to the other day said, I learned when I was in whatever grade that 12 times 12 equals 144.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can forget that. Maybe I forget that for years and never remember it. And then just all of a sudden remember one day, 12 times 12 equals 144. Is Max angry at me because I forgot that? Does mathematics change because I forgot that?
Mm-hmm.
Does mathematics say, maybe I better make 144 or something, make 12 times 12 something different? 12 square could be something different if, no, mathematics doesn't do that. Mathematics just remains being mathematics no matter what we call the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is with truth. Truth is true. I can mess around with it. I can forget it. I can do anything. It's still going to be the same thing when I come back and look. And so I do not affect, the cloud doesn't affect the sky. You know, the objects in the illusion do not affect the truth.
Yeah.
And it's such a wonderful, wonderful thought. And so this, you know, I've really been concentrating and contemplating on this aspect of my holiness. And I know when I first read these, and probably most everybody else, unless they had some really great spiritual awakening beforehand, when I first read this, I really honestly could not imagine that it was about me, that this whole idea of my holiness was about me. Uh-huh. And so I read it as if I were reading it about someone else, and I contemplated as if I were contemplating it about someone else, because I couldn't really find my own holiness. And the reason, you know, he makes it so clear throughout these lessons, the reason that I don't see my own holiness is because I accuse myself, and I accuse my brother, and I believe in this thing of guilt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as long as I think that it's possible in reality to have guilt, that the two could be possibly in the same place, mm-hmm. that love and fear could be in the same place, that innocence and guilt can be in the same place, I'm still going to be way confused. When I recognize that if God is true and real, and I am what he says I am, then and I have no reason not to believe that, because if I think I have a God that is completely omniscient, omnipresent, you know, can do anything, is everything, is perfect, then to believe that he made something imperfect is forgetting that 12 squared is 144. It doesn't change that he made me a perfect thing. So it's remembering, these lessons are all about remembering the truth about myself and remembering my own holiness.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
That sense of holiness is what then grounds me and makes everything else that I see and think and hear filter through that rather than through an ego thought system. And I actually do know my own holiness. And I only know my own holiness because I know that you are holy too.
Right.
I see it in you. And when I see it in you, I know it has to be in me. So these early lessons are all about that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Looking for where that is.
Exactly.
And it's pretty stunning. Pretty stunning.
It is. Yeah. When you were saying, you know, God, two words put together that, you know, the course's jargon uses a little bit different language. It never uses the word make or made for anything to do with truth, because that's reserved in terms of the languaging of the course for what we as seemingly separate selves did. You know, we think we made a world. We think we made up a universe of and populated it with galaxies and stars and planets and oceans and continents and people and animals and minerals and vegetables and yada yada. But yet that is just as the course, you know, echoes some of the non-dual metaphysics from the Eastern world. It's an illusion, but it's a purposeful illusion, because we think that we were able to make something that was foreign to perfect oneness. But the Course uses and reserves the word creation as distinct from making or made or make, all the forms of that verb, for the eternal. And that's what we really are. And that's what we've somehow insanely lost touch of, because we think that we are a reflection, and then worse yet in the descent from in our minds only, in this fantasy only, the descent from this perfect oneness, that we shattered this perfect mirror, we broke apart, you know, the sorcerer's broom and fragmented into countless things. You know, Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall, and you know, we're trying to put the pieces together again within the dream. Well, it's only a dream of fragmentation, so we don't actually have to assemble it there. We have to return to the source of the crazy idea that it was fragmented. While we were talking about this, I looked up the word mirror, and I found it in several places, but one place in fairly concentrated is in chapter 14 in section 9, the reflection of holiness. How about if I read a little of that? Are you still there, Lynn?
I'm here, and I think that sounds great. Yes.
Oh, okay. It starts out, this is in paragraph 5 of section 9 of chapter 14, which is the teaching for truth section, and section 9 is the reflection of holiness. In paragraph 5, it jumps in and says, "In this world, you can become a spotless mirror in which the holiness of your Creator shines forth from you to all around you." So again, the mirror metaphor, that it's a reflection, that the best we can hope for in this world, which is what we identify with, is to become a reflection of the undoing of the fragmentation. And the how would we reflect that? Well, obviously, and of course points this out in countless ways, is that we're clueless as to what oneness is, because we've come so far down the rabbit hole, so far down the ladder of duality that and fragmentation, that we think, and we're pretty well convinced most of the time, that, you know, there's a Bruce and a Lynn, and there's everyone else who's listening, and there's you know, planets that are different from other planets, there are people that are different from other people, cultures that are different from other cultures, you know, politics, you know, that differs, there's genders, there's sexual orientation, there's philosophies, there's, you know, dietary preferences. The list could go on and on and on, but we think those are different because we are so heavily invested in a world that makes big deals out of all those differences and does it purposefully to keep the differences real, because we want the mirror to be shattered, because we think that we can hide in a little fragment and be, you know, remain unscathed from the ravages of the imagined punishment that we think is going to happen. Okay, no, let me go back to I'll start that paragraph over. In this world, you can become a spotless mirror in which the holiness of your Creator shines forth from you to all around you. You can reflect heaven here. And there's the reflection. We can reflect heaven by seeing the sameness, by looking past the barriers, like you were talking about earlier, Lynn, the things that appear to block the sky, the clouds. We can look through the clouds with the Holy Spirit's, you know, aka the Jesus of the Course, aka Inner Kindness Teacher's laser vision, and see the sun. It's undimmed, and it never diminishes. And then it continues, third sentence, it says, "Yet no reflections of the images of other gods must dim the mirror that would hold God's reflection in it." So the reflections of images of other gods, well, the other gods are all the specialness idols that we've made, right? They're all the things that we think are going to make us happy in the world. And, oh, I pulled one over on God. I was able to have this great vacation, or this cool new car, or this great job, or this great romantic interlude, or incredible meal, or, you know, or I accomplished this thing in my career, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, it doesn't matter. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. But when we identify with those things, and identify with anything that involves space, time, individuality, or guilt, you know, and that's the gist of it. I like to put those letters together that way: the guilt, individuality, space, time. Anything that involves any of those four things, it's a pretty good bet that we're just looking at a dark mirror, looking through a dark mirror darkly, and a fragmented one of that, right?
Exactly. So, yeah. Well, and just to kind of firm up a thought here that you're presenting, and just, I don't want to interrupt, but the idea of guilt, this is what's become so clear to me, is that the only thing that's standing between me and knowing my own holiness is this belief in guilt. Mm-hmm. And so what you were just talking about, you know, this new car, these, you know, all these things that we look at in the world as being something that is going to give me a boost, make me happy, make me feel good, heal my aching heart, whatever, all of those things. When I choose them instead of spirit, choose them instead of God, choose them instead of love, I feel guilt.
Right.
That's the only thing that's possible, is that I'm going to feel guilt for choosing anything over love. And here's what he's talking about this in this paragraph, that anything I choose over love is going to make me feel guilty, and that's going to mar the mirror, and I'm not going to feel holy. I'm not going to feel loved or lovable because I'm murdering God by buying that car. Right. You know, literally in my mind, whether I acknowledge it or not, I am murdering God by buying that car. I'm saying, I want this more than truth. I want physical love with a partner more than love with God. I want, you're really putting
yourself. In your dreams.
Yeah. You're putting yourself in a place where you're actually replacing God with objects, people, thoughts, ideas, and that can only bring about guilt. And guilt is the source of all the unpleasantry that we have in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah. I'll let you continue on with the paragraph.
Oh, no, that's a perfect compliment. It wasn't an interruption at all. It was basically a compliment to what we were just talking about. And I was thinking about, well, another place where mirrors occasionally come to mind is when you hop in the car and check your rearview mirror, oftentimes the newer vehicles have a little thing stenciled on the mirror that says, you know, objects in the mirror closer than they appear. Well, that's, I think, a great, you know, metaphor for the ideas never leave their source. You know, it's like, well, the beliefs and the guilt and and, you know, all the things that we think we've projected outside of ourselves are actually a whole lot closer than they appear. Because they're exactly coincident in our mind, even though in space they seem different. But we never, you know, nothing left its source. The mind has not been capable, except in dreams, of making things that are apart and outside ourself. And that one self is the essence that we've gotten so far away from in our belief only, that we think that, you know, it's this impossible, you know, undreaming. Yeah, with apologies to Don Quixote or Man from La Mancha, right? You know, it's really is an impossible dream, but we think we've dreamt it. We actually believe we've pulled it off, and that's where the terror comes in. That's where the terror of the mirror is thinking that somehow this haunting reflection is going to do us in. That's the fantasy figure in our nightmarish dream is going to, you know, whatever, choose your favorite, you know, internal monster, is going to do us in, because we think that we made, you know, a 2 + 2 = 4 universe, like, you know, Ken talks about one of his workshops. But really, 2 + 2 = 5 is equally in insane as 2 + 2 = 4, because there's only oneness. And now I'm just, you know, I'm not attacking mathematics on the level of form, but just the metaphysical idea that anything, there could be anything other than perfect oneness. And then another favorite phrase of Ken's is you know, Jesus would be a horrible math teacher because he can't count past one. I just think that's kind of cute, because, you know, it's like, well, and obviously we need to use those other digits in our everyday world. You know, if you try to balance your checkbook you know, look at the clock or do all the, you know, the countless things that we do every day that involve both numbers and letters, you know, we'd be in a sad state if we, you know, didn't use what we've learned in the world with numbers and letters and all the stuff that involves duality. But the idea is if there's only perfect oneness, then yeah, you know, our inner kindness teacher has no curriculum that involves anything other than gently returning us to oneness. There was a workshop that Tom and Linda Carpenter gave, and when I live in Southern Oregon, and we helped arrange a workshop that a day-long workshop that they gave there in Ashland, Oregon, and wonderful time. And the vignette that he shared that sticks out in my mind the most is he talks about, you know, some of his reflections about where he was going through this process of looking at all the things in his life that he felt really horrible about, and you know, the transgressions and things that he was, you know, starting to examine the guilt, the unconscious guilt, and bring it back into his mind and look at it. And that was, I mean, I'm going to paraphrase greatly here, but that was the what I got from it. Is that as we do that, there's this tendency to condemn yourself instead of, you know, making it outside yourself, which is the whole strategy for making up a world, so that there's a victim and a victimizer. Well, if you collapse that, if you say, oh, the mirror is just, you know, a metaphor for something I tried to fling outside myself and get it away from me, you know, not in my mind's backyard, please. and when it starts coming home to roost, and you say, oh, these thoughts, I don't like at all because they implicate me, you know. Well, fortunately, the me that's implicated, it doesn't exist. But we the observer is the decision-making mind. That's the essence that Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi and so many other mystics around the planet, both Eastern and Western, and so many different cultures have been hinting at. And of course, in miracles, I think, you know, adds to that the purposiveness of the unconscious guilt is because we think that we pull it off, and that's why we project an illusion. That's why we made up the world, why we made up a mirror and then shattered it in our dream, in our nightmare, and yet there's nothing there. It's just a joke. It's just an incredibly vast, silly joke.
You know, this is what's so beautiful about the work, Byron Katie's, the work, mm-hmm. Ho'oponopono.
Yep.
I'm trying to think. There are so many things that people have come up with now
right.
that are means of looking at these particular things and recognizing that they're not true.
Exactly.
So, you know, I can understand if you... you know, whatever it is that you do method-wise, it's all the process of forgiveness. And this is what, you know, people don't understand the process of forgiveness and don't do it well because they don't really understand that it is a process. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you have to actually go through the steps in order to actually perform the miracle. Because mm-hmm. that's what forgiveness is, the home of miracles. You know, that's not just a nice saying. It's saying that when I practice forgiveness, I work miracles. That's, right. I mean, there's a connection there. And so, I mean, it's an intimate connection because it's how it actually works. So the idea of like the work with Byron Katie, really all she's doing is questioning the reality of her thoughts.
Mm-hmm,
Choose again, Diedrich Wolsack's group method. All that's doing is looking at the thought, bringing its reality into question,
mm-hmm.
Observing it from different angles, you know, mm-hmm. saying, well, if this is real, that can't be. And if this is, you know, I could not possibly have done this. You come to the point where the only thing you can reflect is your own innocence. When you get to the point where you say, you know, who would I be without that thought? Bam.
Yeah. And I like it. Yeah, I think it's four steps or four questions that and I haven't studied hardly at all Byron Katie's work, but I remember reading one of the preliminary books that she put out, or at least a portion of it, to where I got to the turn it around part and the idea of, you know, do I know this is true? Do I absolutely know that it's true? And how can I be sure that it's true? Well, that's basically saying, can I question the thought system that brought this turmoil, this upset around? Can I invert ego's logic? Could I use the exact same prison structure that the ego would keep me in bondage with and use it instead for a means for liberation, turn it into a classroom instead of a prison? And that's what we're doing. Every time we bring it back inside, we, you know, reel it back in and say, oh yeah, this is just a mirror, this little fragment, this experience that seems to be a shattered piece of a mirror, a shard of perfect oneness that by looking at it at the surface, it seems, oh well, this is apart from me and this is separate from me, and that experience of separation is the source of unimaginable pain and angst that we need to look at. But we only have to look at it a little at a time. We don't have to have the full whammy of it happen in our awareness. We just have to look at every little twinge, whether it's, you know, seems to be horrific at any given moment or just a minor annoyance, and say it's all the same. It's because it's all the same dream. There's no order, difficulty, and miracles. And each little fragment of the mirror is a opportunity for the miracle to undo ego's thought system. We take a look at anything that we're not at peace with and a grievance about or discomfort with or a regret or anxiety or whatever. I mean, anything that does not feel peaceful, bring it back into mind, but look at it with Holy Spirit. Look at it with our inner kindness teacher and say, oh yeah, this had no effect on the self that I am in truth eternally. And it didn't shatter. It was only a dream of a shattered mirror and a dream of the mirror in the first place. Should we finish that first paragraph?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Okay. Let me just start again, because I think it helps to kind of build up the sequence here. Okay, in this world, you can become a spotless mirror in which the holiness of your Creator shines forth from you to all around you. And that's what happens whenever we reveal, release, and replace using whatever methodology, you know, worked for us, whatever teaching. You can reflect heaven here. And that's the place where we reflect the oneness that we never left. Yet no reflections of the images of other gods must dim the mirror that would hold God's reflection in it. And there's all the various forms of specialness that we're seemingly so addicted to, thinking that they're going to work. The maladaptive solutions to the non-existent problem, as Ken Wapnick's wonderful phrase reflects. Earth can reflect heaven or hell, God or the ego. And there's our choice between, you know, is it a prison or a classroom? Are we going to use it to reinforce the unconscious guilt or undo it by forgiving it, by just looking at it with that awareness that we never left the dream? You need but leave the mirror clean and clear of all the images of hidden darkness you have drawn upon it. And that's, you know, when we bring the darkness to the light, when we bring our ideas of discomfort and our thoughts of anxiety and dread and frustration and worry and you know, jealousy and bitterness, and you know, the list could go on. Just pick any emotion or feeling or thought that is disquieting or discomforting, and that's a worthy candidate. You know, anything that's in front of your face at a given day, as Gary Renard's teachers say, is a suitable object for our forgiveness classroom, isn't it? You need but leave the mirror clean and clear of all the images of hidden darkness you have drawn upon it. And we leave it clean and clear by bringing those dark things to the light, by revealing, first of all, that we've had those thoughts and that the things in our world that we think are outside ourselves that aren't making us happy, or in some cases making us very unhappy, are just reflections. They're just reflections, and fake ones at that. They're fraudulent. So we reveal those things and we release them when we get to the light and say, yeah, I'm willing to let go of that. I'm willing to turn it around. I'm willing to see that I've invested truth in this, but it only has the seeming truth that I gave it, and what I gave it, what I made out of it, not what I created, because I'm not the creator in that sense. The self that I think I am is definitely not the creator, but I'm certainly capable, using the vast power of my mind, to make up this immense, immense dream we call a universe, and to hide from this immense horrific fantasy called guilt, and we think we pulled it off. So we have to use the specifics to undo the specifics. And then what's left when we reveal it and release it is it's automatically replaced, because that's the light behind the clouds that was always there. So it says, you need but leave the mirror clean and clear of all the images of hidden darkness you have drawn upon it. God will shine upon it of himself. Only the clear reflection of himself can be perceived upon it. And that is the truth of what we are, that we never left. And we know, I think we all intuitively know, which is why we were drawn to studying A Course in Miracles and to all the different, you know, techniques that have fed into it, the different teachings, and as you were mentioning, Glenn, the different modalities and practices that we've found helpful, and they're all part of it. I mean, obviously we have countless different ways, since we think that we've made up this diversity of getting back to the oneness that we never left. And it's only differences in form, but not in content ultimately. As we forgive ourselves, that content is the only illusion that is the undo, you know, and that content takes countless forms, but it's the one content that undoes the content of the mind that we call ego, that that brings us the peace.
That's it. Oh yeah, exactly. And so the peace is really what we're looking for. That's really where, you know, if you ask people, what do you want? Almost everyone is going to tell you at some level that what they really want is peace. It may be that I want security in my home. I want, you know, people to love me. But really it's that feeling of being okay, that feeling of wholeness that comes about when you know that nothing can harm you. And that's why it's so essential for us, which, you know, I'm not pointing out specialness in us, because I have a whole idea or whole understanding really of why there are some waves of the ocean that when they flip up, you know, they drag up stuff and they flip up here and they wave around and they drag up stuff and move things forward. That's what the ocean waves do. They move things and bring things to the shore, take things to the deep and bring things to the shore. That's all we're doing. We're waving.
That's a good metaphor. And it's actually a bit more tumultuous than the Mickey Mouse with the runaway splitting broom and buckets that are sloshing around. But as you were saying that, I was at the ocean and the stuff that comes up from the ocean, I was thinking of things I've seen lately of, I think a young man who figured out a way to invent a device that, or technology that basically takes these giant, essentially floating dumps in the middle of the ocean.
Garbage dumps.
Yeah. What's that? You've seen it too?
Garbage dumps. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because in the middle of the Pacific, for example, there's a word that they use for these huge areas where the waves and the motion of the currents in the ocean have brought all this floating trash together in these large, you know, whirling dumps, basically floating dumps in the middle
islands
of the ocean.
Islands of trash.
Islands of trash, and so now there's people who are coming up with ways of you know, getting rid of that trash and cleaning both the solid and the liquid waste by devising these things where the motion of the ocean itself will then cause these the liquid particles of you know, like oil spills and things like that, as well as some of the solid matter to fall into these traps that then can be, essentially harvested and then brought to shore, cleaned up. You know, obviously it's a massive undertaking, but it's I think it's a nice symbolic metaphor of there's the intent to look at the junk that we keep out of mind. You know, what could be farther out of mind than a giant trash heap in the middle of the ocean, you know, and it's not something that most cruise lines are going to, you know, have as a destination. Hey, let's go look at the big, you know, mile mini mile across floating dump, you know. But that's
just
it's
invented
kind
a new tourist thing
of
there.
really, you know. Heck with Tahiti and Fiji, you know. Let's go look at the floating dump, right? But that's kind of a metaphor for the part of that shattered mirror, you know, that we don't want to look at. The junk that's there that we need to look at in order to have the purity that we think we've lost, we need to look at it and see, oh, nothing happened. In this case, you know, the metaphor would be we can undo it by going there and you know, and there's a way to clean it up. Yeah. And, you know, no matter what we've – unlike this world where, you know, no matter how we try to fix it, and it reminds me of a political conversation that I started to get into yesterday afternoon with some friends, and just watching my mind starting to get invested and say, nah, I don't think so. I'm not going to go there. But I'm sure you can relate to that. You know, but it's just, and so what I brought up in this conversation was, you know, something that I thought was innocuous enough for this group that probably wasn't familiar that much with A Course in Miracles, but could relate to the celebrity culture, you know, of a few decades ago. And that was, there was an episode of the Merv Griffin Show, if anybody remembers that talk show host from years ago. He, you know, they've had a very popular show for a long time. And during, I guess it was probably the 70s or 80s, he had, it's been a few decades anyway. He had Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was the founder of the Transcendental Meditation Movement, as a guest on his show. And at that time, you know, TM, or as it was called, it became very popular and with a certain group of the population. And so he had him on the show and he was talking about various things. And at one point the conversation got around to politics and people in the audience were, you know, hurling their litany of grievances about the political system and how messed up it was. And sound familiar? Right? you know, the corruption and the abuse and so on and so forth, yada, yada. And at one point, you know, I think Merv Griffin, as the host, finally realized, you know, that the audience contributions were starting to dominate. And he said, well, have this guest here. You know, let's see what the Maharishi says. And, you know, what do you think about, you know, all the problems that people are having with the politicians? And so, you know, the room quieted and he gave his answer, which was, I'm going to paraphrase greatly because it has been a few decades, but you might be able to Google it. Anyway, he said something to the effect of, well, there's no point in blaming the politicians because they're just a reflection of your consciousness. Wow. And that was the gist of what he said. And I don't think he said it in a way that was, you know, don't take action or be an activist or do what you can. But it was just, you know, always remember that it's your mind that you're seeing mirrored here. It's a reflection. And there's the mirror again, right? And the whole room just fell totally quiet for a few seconds. It was just dumbfounded, like, what? Wait, we didn't want, that was not what we wanted to hear. We wanted to, you know, have you at least take sides in some fashion, right? That awareness, and he was, you know, very helpfully bringing it back to the mind again, which is, you know, where any real meditation or any real peace has to come from, right? You know, kudos to you, Maharishi, right? And, you know, is not what the audience wanted to hear, but that's, you know, again, a mirror or a reflection of how it's not what we want to hear. We don't want to hear that. You know, what do you mean? There's something I can. Not something I can do in the world that's going to make me happy. There isn't some perfect combination of fixes in the ocean or politics or, you know, my household or my finances or my community or, you know, my legislature, my relationships or, you know, my health regimen that's going to somehow make me happy. And we keep forgetting that what we are is a created being that fortunately we don't have access to that creation from this dream. Hallelujah. That's you know, we can't mess that up, but we can certainly have
handle the truth.
Yeah, right, exactly. But we can massively you know, dream that there's a way to hide from it and spend seemingly countless lifetimes in this silly fugitive dream that takes various forms and seeming incarnations and yada, yada, and yada, that goes on and on and on. And, you know, like Groundhog Day, which we would, you know, some of us just celebrated the annual return of the Bill Murray movie. And all of its great metaphors, because, you know, we just keep doing this over and over again until we get the mirror, bring all the little fragments of the mirror back to mind and see that nothing happened. Not one note in Heaven's Song was missed. So shall I read the next paragraph? I'll go ahead and read the paragraph 6 of chapter 14, Teaching for Truth. In this world, the first one starts, in this world you can become a spotless mirror. Okay, the next one, paragraph 6, is reflections are seen in light. And obviously we're not going to see them in the darkness. The metaphor of darkness, obviously, is anything having to do with space or time or our individuality. And, of course, the guilt that propagated all those dreams, aspects of the dream. In darkness, in the dream, they are obscure, and their meaning seems to lie only in shifting interpretations. There's the world of what's made, right? What we made up, rather than in themselves. And that's another really helpful idea, that the body and the world and everything, the whole cosmos, is neutral. How could a dream be anything other than neutral? It only has the meaning that we give it, as those early workbook lessons brilliantly remind us. And that's why the admonition on this, you know, just look around slowly. Don't let your eyes linger on any one specific object, or notice in your mind, you know, better yet, notice in your mind when you want to say, oh, this phone in my hand, or this cord to the USB headset in my other hand, you know. I'm speaking very specifically as live examples while we're going to, you know, they're different from a piece of the painted sheetrock on the and textured sheetrock on the wall, that, you know, a 4-inch patch of that is different from the 4-inch or 5-inch or whatever object in my hand that I call a phone. That, no, those, they're all equally unreal. But I've made this phone more important than other objects in the room, like a stapler or the file folder of things that I'm getting ready to prepare to do my taxes with. Or,
right. And
or,
until
or a
sock, you need
you
those
know, and
things.
A sock drawer. Right, right.
Until you need those things, it has no value. And when you need it, it has a value. That's why these things shift. It's
exactly.
Like, and that's why the sameness of this is why when Jesus says, you know, you could actually heal the sick and raise the dead, move mountains. You can do all these things, but you don't, because you don't understand the whole concept of there's no order of difficulty in miracles.
Right.
If you understood that, you'd know there's no mountain to move, no sick to raise, to dead to raise, no sick to heal, none of that. So it's this, what is it that I'm actually seeing that we're talking about here? And that's the whole, you can't have both. That's what he's saying here. I can't have the world of form and God at the same time. They don't equate. They're not in the same, there's one is real and the other's not. Mm-hmm. And I can't have the unreal and the real both.
Nice.
It's impossible.
Yep.
So you have to pick one. And why don't we pick the right one? Why do we always pick the illusion?
Well, it seems like always, but I think the more we use the mind training that the Course represents to look at our unforgiveness, to look at our resistance and our motivation behind wanting to stay in the dark, and wanting to keep the mirror obscured and dirty and seemingly impure, because we think that there's differences, because we think that there's a distinction between one thing and another in the dream, that wanting is a reflection or a manifestation of the desire to keep separate. And that's where the impurity comes in. That a few years ago, I was thinking of the word purity and how that ties into holiness and innocence. and that the course talks about on a metaphysical level, and the purity of anything is how faithfully does it have only one thing. You know, like we look at a bar of soap and you know, it might say 99.9% pure, right? Well, that means there's only less than 0.5% of the molecules in that particular object that are of some different substance or quality or nature. Well, the purity of our true mind is completely 100% all that is. I mean, that's all we are. But within the dream, we can dream of all kinds of things that seem to be different. And so the purity is tainted and corrupted by default in this dream of differences, this duality dream. So there's no way that we're going to make it pure. There's no way. But we can bring the thoughts that we have about it and say, oh, that, hey, what do you know? That is only just one example of something that I made up. I can afford to own up to it and recognize that it had no impact on the awareness that is now using the power of the mind, the decision-making faculty of the mind, to look at that fragmented reflection, that shard of a mirror, and realize it's the same thing. Illusion A equals illusion B equals illusion C. Those little fragments of the mirror all reflect either one of two thought systems. They either reflect the perfect oneness that we never left, or they reflect ego's dream of separation. And all we have to do is clean the mirror. And so it continues. It says, clean but the mirror. Well, let me back up again. Reflections are seen in light. In darkness they are obscure, and their meaning seems to lie only in shifting interpretations rather than in themselves. The reflection of God needs no interpretation. It is clear. Clean but the mirror and the message that shines forth from what the mirror holds out for everyone to see. No one can fail to understand. And that's the beauty of kindness, is that when we're willing to look at our unkindness to ourselves and what seems to be our unkindness to others, since the others are just, you know, aspects of the mirror that we've seemingly chosen to believe are outside ourselves, then and that's why we're not healed alone. We're healed in our mind the instant we forgive ourselves for wanting to make differences a big deal and wanting to, you know, have a chip on our shoulder and get into a fight and make grievances and differences of opinion and understanding and differences of beliefs a big deal. You know, when we catch ourselves doing that, whether it's a political conversation or watching about an environmental seeming crisis on TV or getting a bill in the mail that we don't like or you know, looking at anything in the world that upsets us, no matter what it is, and see that that's just a reflection of a choice for a little fragmented mirror that we have chosen to make impure, to make unreal, and to somehow convince us that our perfect innocence, our perfect holiness could be shattered. That's just a silly joke. It's just silly. We can look at it. We can afford to look at that from that perspective above the battleground and see that, you know, nothing happened. You know, and that was the part of the story that I guess I forgot to finish of Tom Carpenter's examination in this workshop he gave in Ashland a few years ago, that he said, you know, he was just having, he calls it his brother, his inner teacher, that's his name for it. And he said, he asked brother, you know, well, after he went through this long laundry list of you know, things that he thought he messed up with in his life, and as he was reviewing this, you know, this in a large sense, he said, and then he asked brother, his inner kindness teacher, for his response, and it was just quiet. And from that he got, oh, nothing happened. I have not usurped the throne of perfect oneness. I haven't thrown God under the bus. There's no way. And that's what the sorcerer, you know, we've gone through a lot of metaphors in this hour. That's what the sorcerer realized when he came back and found Mickey Mouse with the runaway brooms and buckets, you know, that seemingly fragmented all these, you know, chaotic things that, you know, seemed to beset us. Nothing happened. all is forgiven. You know, he wasn't upset with the apprentice. He just said, oh, yeah, not a big deal. We'll clean up. Not the ocean on the level of four. We're not gonna handle it there, obviously. But we need, you know, because there's always gonna be something that comes up. Certainly, we should do what we can, you know, out motivated by kindness as a reflection of that kindness, to do what we can to be helpful in the world of form. But to remember that we're not gonna clean up the world, because the world was made to be a mess. And that was kind of the place that I was trying to hint at in the conversation yesterday. Just that you know, it's only by looking at the mind, as Maharishi said, that we're gonna get out of our grievances. We're gonna escape from the condemnation that we're making, and be returned to that spotless reflection. And then from there, as the Course says, it's just a simple step that, you know, God takes himself metaphorically. We don't have to do anything. And I think that's reflected in those three steps of forgiveness. We reveal to ourselves our investment in the ego. We release that investment, and then it's replaced automatically. The first two require our cooperation with Holy Spirit, aka Jesus of the Course, aka our inner kindness teacher. The third step, we just get the heck out of the way. That's done completely for us. And the replacement, the reason it's done for us is because we don't do anything. We just get the heck out of the way. And the reality, the truth of what we are that's eternal has always been there. The light that the clouds obscured was always there. So we don't have to do anything. We just observe it and celebrate.
That's it.
The joy and the peace and the eternal exhilaration, if that's possible to mix those words, is what's left over. That's where the unchanging ecstasy of that peace comes in, the holiness that is so infinitely comforting that we, you know, hardly get anything but just little glimpses of now and then when we let go of our grievances and forgive, is awaiting us.
Well, and what you're saying, there's so, and we could just go on and on and on with this, because
we have.
It's where, you know, Jesus says to us, if you could just see one brother, one person,
yes,
as wholly worthy of forgiveness, mm-hmm, if you could see a brother sinless, if you could just look out and see that there is perfection, sinlessness, and holiness, you would see that the only way that you see that is because it's reflecting from you. You're the one who is, you are sinless, holy, and innocent, worthy of forgiveness, everything. And so it's my decision not to see sin, not to see evil. It's my decision just not to see anything other than what the reflection of love. And that's what Jesus means by removing the blocks to the, yep, awareness of love's presence. All those things are the blocks to my awareness of my brother's sinlessness and my own. And when I remove those things, I allow those things to be removed, then all I see is peace. It doesn't bring peace. It reveals peace.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't bring love. It reveals love.
Yeah,
it removes the blocks to my awareness of myself, and
yes,
I mean, that's what this whole course is about.
Exactly. It's so simple, isn't it? Thank you, Lynn. Hey, I was going to make a quick announcement again. It's coming up in June, and thank you again, Lynn, for being the person who helped me make the connection with this event that's happening in June in Estes Park, Colorado. It's the fifth annual. I will be a participant in that and a contributor, along with Gary and Cindy Laura Renard and David Hoffmeister, who I'm going to be actually interviewing on a video in just a couple hours, and the Maria Felipe and Craig Villarubia, Lori Coburn, Dove Fishman, of course, and I believe Regina's going to be there, not as a presenter, but she's going to be attending.
She's
Regina Don Akers
coming, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, this is June 16th through the 19th. It's called Weekend of Freedom, but it's actually a four-day event, and so we'll have 4 days to immerse ourselves in opportunities to remind each other and practice our kindness lessons and see that it really is, as everyone, all the teachers that I admire suggest, it's a self-study course. And yet it can be a fun social occasion and an opportunity to practice forgiveness, and to look at all the ways that we have seen division and to use our seemingly separate selves as opportunities to come together to reinforce that understanding and to choose once again. And so I'm looking forward to it very much. And one thing that Dove, I've already had 4 recordings that are up on the weekendoffreedomretreat.org website, if people want to check that out.
I just posted the link.
Yeah, so I've had interviews with Cheryl and Dove and Lori and Craig, and I'm going to do another one with David, and also I'll be doing one with Barrett, and then one with Gary and Cindy a few weeks from now. The retreat is going to be just a blast. And one of the things I think is really cool, and thanks for letting me have an extra minute or two here, is that it's going to be, in addition to presentations, it's going to be a lot of interaction. So it won't be just the stand at a podium, the presenter standing at the podium and everybody else listening. It's going to be a lot of roundtable conversations. Those roundtables are going to be essentially, everyone gets involved. And the emphasis is on equality and equal participation. So I think that's really important. And Dove brought that out in the conversation we had. So I'm really looking forward to this. And I hope anyone listening that is the least bit inclined will take advantage of this opportunity to come together for 4 days in Estes Park, Colorado in June of this year. So
it looks beautiful. It's going to be really cool. And, I'm very excited about this, and because it's right here in Colorado where I live.
Yeah.
It's not like, and it's central. I think it's kind of cool that, nobody really has to, you don't have to go completely across the country, no matter where you are to get here. And it's beautiful. Estes Park at the time of the year is just stunning. And I'm very excited that you guys got the place at that time.
Yeah.
That's a very prime time. So.
Yeah, kudos to all those who put that together. And I'm having fun helping with the website, and I'll contribute as well. So, thanks again. And I'll post the additional videos on both weekendoffreedomretreat.org as well as on acimblog.com. So thanks again, Lynn, and have a wonderful week of forgiveness lessons and classroom activity in the Dreamscape, everyone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, before we go, I just wanted to say Cheryl just posted that she wanted to mention that the YMCA has counselors available for children to have activities while their parents are attending sessions during the retreat Thursday and Friday. So come on Thursday and Friday, and if you come and you bring your kids for a vacation, because this is a perfect spot for a family vacation, bring your family, and there's people who will hang out with your kids and take them to crafts or horseback riding or I don't know what all, but, lots of cool stuff that they could be doing. So
hiking, swimming, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Night walks, I think, are planned. All kinds of cool stuff. Yep. Yep. I'm very much looking forward to it. And again, kudos to all the presenters and the organizers like Cheryl and Barrett and Dove. So, yeah. Very cool.
Very cool. All right. Yep. I love you, Bruce. And thank you.
Likewise.
I'll send you this recording. And thanks for posting them on your ACIM blog. I love to look and see myself on someone else's website. Anyway.
We're all mirrors of each other, aren't we?
We are. Yep. All right. I love you, Bruce. And we're getting ready to meditate now. So I will talk to you again next week. All right.